Fletcher High School temporarily shuts down due to a cluster of COVID cases. Early voting begins on Monday, and the mosh is on the move. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning and live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, all of the top stories of the week with our Friday roundtable. Already getting your calls? Join us. It's 549-2937. Then later, get outdoors this weekend for a brush with nature at the Jack's Arboretum. We'll have a preview. But first, it's Friday, and here to break down a busy week in the news, we welcome Emily Block of the Florida Times-Union. Good morning.
Good morning.
Our new contributor, John Delaney, former mayor and president emeritus of the University of North Florida. Hi, John.
Hey, what's up?
Journalist and writer Nakeisha Williams back with us once again. Good morning, Nakeisha.
Good morning, Melissa. Good morning, everyone.
And Bill Bortsfield, our digital editor at WJCT. Hi, Bill.
Hey, Melissa. Good morning, everybody.
It's good to have all four of you with us. Lots to talk about this week, and we'll go to everyone's calls in a moment. It's 549-2937 to jump in with our Friday roundtable. But first this hour, the latest on the pandemic by the numbers. There are now 500 deaths from COVID reported in Duval County, and more than 50,000 positive cases reported across the Northeast Florida region. This from the State Department of Health. Meanwhile, the pandemic has forced the temporary closure of Fletcher High School at the beach. Students at Fletcher have been sent home for virtual learning for at least the next few days because there is something of a cluster of positive COVID cases at the school. Apparently, an off-campus party during homecoming week may be to blame for the outbreak. We're going to go to your calls on this in a few moments. Give us a call now at 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And our Facebook page is open. Let's begin with the Times Union's education reporter, Emily Block. Emily, what do we know about the outbreak at Fletcher High School?
Sure, Melissa. So we know as of this morning or late last evening, the Duval School's dashboard, which is tracking cases by school, lists about, I think it was 32 cases last I checked at that school. We know that at least 27 of those cases happened or were reported within the last like 48 hours, were reported as a result of whatever ensued this weekend. We know from students and parents that attend the school that it was homecoming week. They didn't have a dance, but they had Friday night homecoming football game with the court, and then after those games throughout the weekend, there were at least two parties that the school district is saying took the brunt of the reason why there are so many cases so quickly at the school.
So a couple of student parties where we don't know for sure, but kids might have been crowded in together without masks and distancing. Is that right?
Right. We don't know specifics because the phrasing that the school district and that the Department of Health are using are that students don't want to be snitches. Of course, there's a lot more gravity to that when it's life or death. But what we do know from parents and from the students that are willing to speak to us is that there were at least two parties. And who knows what happened there, how close students were together, if they were or weren't wearing masks, which I feel like is probably unlikely. So.
Okay.
There's a lot of unknown, which makes it scary. A
lot of unknowns. But Bill Bortsfield, WJCT's digital editor, this is the first closure of a Duval County public schools since campuses reopened in August. And the threshold, according to the school district, is if 20% of the school's population is impacted. That's what we do know, right?
Yeah, and the good news is the system is working as it should. I mean, Fletcher took quick action, and so that's the good news because, of course, as we know, this can grow very quickly, and a lot of folks both at the local and state level and the national level are worried about a second wave, as I'm sure most of us have noticed, that do get out and about. We are starting to see more people, not just just anywhere out and about. And looking at that COVID dashboard that Emily was mentioning, it looks like the second highest right now is San Pablo Elementary with 11 cases. And most of the cases, most of the schools do just have one or two, but there are some that have more than that. Like, for example, Wolfson High has got 5. Southside Estates Elementary has 4. So it's definitely something that every single principal has got to keep an extremely close eye on.
And Nikisha Williams, we have heard anecdotally there are quite a number of quarantine cases at schools in St. John's County as well, although there have been no closures there. Still, this is something parents, teachers, and students are watching closely because we went through the whole public debate about whether to send kids back to school, how to send them back to school. And now we're watching school districts try to manage this as best they can.
Yeah, school districts are trying to manage it as best they can. And I think Duval is doing a really good job with their COVID dashboard and keeping parents and administrators and teachers and anyone who comes into contact. That COVID is not going away anytime soon. And even once it does, and there's a...
Okay, and as we try to reconnect Nikisha, John Delaney, as she, oh, there she is. Okay, we're having a little trouble hearing you, Nikisha. We'll try to work on that connection. John Delaney, as Nikisha pointed out, this is just a reminder that this pandemic remains with us, although people have returned for the most part to their daily lives. We do now have 500 deaths from COVID in Duval County, 50,000 positive cases across the region. This is a long haul effort dealing with this public health threat.
Yeah, no question. Sometimes people go to sleep, and it hasn't really touched me here in my circle, but as health officials have warned, when you put people together, it's going to spread. And spread utilization of vaccine, it still is. Like a sore number, it's just a question of when we'll end up getting it unless we are just completely quarantined and kind of locked down.
Yeah. Emily Block, what else can you tell us about what the district is telling you about their planning for Fletcher High School and other schools? When might Fletcher High even reopen? What do we know?
Sure. So first off, I want to say that this closure, even though there is that 20% threshold in their own policy about closing, the school district said they weren't even sure that they had reached that yet. As like we'll see in the dashboard, it took a while for that to even reflect. They're saying that this closure was preventative. They said that as they saw 16 cases reported in one day, they wanted to get ahead of it before they even reached a 20% impact, but that they were pretty sure that even with those 16 cases, which is where it started, and now we're at 27 at least, that they believed at least 20% would either have been exposed or needed to quarantine or actually have COVID-19, whether it's asymptomatic or symptomatic. So they said that this was to kind of get ahead of the game, clean the school, and then see where things stand on Monday. And that's when we're supposed to know what happens next. They said as late as Monday, possibly sooner, but I think it'll probably be on Monday because today is the teacher planning day. They're probably still getting their ducks in a row. The Department of Health is taking the lead on the contact tracing. So for a lot of this, the school district's own hands are tied. But they said by Monday, we should know if school will continue to be virtual and extend that closure or if they will go back on campus that Tuesday.
All right. And if you're just tuning in, it's our Friday roundtable. 549-2937. Give us a call as we talk about the closure of Fletcher High School and other news of the week. Kevin tweets the show, yes, please point out there are no classes district-wide today. It is the end of the marking period. Another tweet, some of these schools act like we're not even in a pandemic. I would not be surprised to see more clusters. Bill Bortsfield, what about that? I think that, as you pointed out a minute ago, the school districts do have a very difficult job with this problem, trying to quarantine positive students and teachers while still conducting class, with some kids in class and some kids learning virtually.
Yeah, no question. They have a very difficult balancing act. But again, I go back and I would say that what's going on at Fletcher shows that they are taking this very seriously, the fact that they may not have actually reached that 20% threshold and went ahead and took a proactive preventative step right out of the gate, I take as a positive sign, as I think any parent would. While none of us wants to see a child's education potentially slowed down for even a few hours, at the same time, we don't want to see a child or a parent or a grandparent get sick or worse. So this is what should happen at the district. And yeah, as the school year moves on, we may see other instances like this. The hope is that the district is getting better and better at pivoting when they must do online learning. And of course, that obviously puts an additional burden on parents as well.
Let's go to some calls now. We're getting parents calling in, 549-2937. Lynn on the South Side. Hi, Lynn. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. I was listening with interest to the topic this morning. I have a student at Atlantic Coast High School here in Jacksonville, and we actually received a phone call last night that two students had tested positive and that the health department was looking into it. But what is concerning to me is we've received numerous phone calls like that from the school or from the district. And it's not being reflected on the dashboard. So I think parents are worried about the transparency when students test positive, how many students or staff test positive, and whether that's actually something we can actually find accurate information about to make our decisions. That's all. Thank you.
Thank you, Lynn. Nikisha Williams back with us now. What about that? The parents, you know, frantically just searching dashboards for information and hoping that it's accurate. Oh, we've lost her again. We'll try again. We're in the pandemic too, John Delaney, which means all of you are distanced from our radio studio. That's why we sometimes struggle with this. What about, I don't know if you could hear her call, John, but she's a parent with a child at Atlantic Coast High, and just wondering if they're getting completely transparent information from schools. You hear that a lot from parents. Again, we want to stress, we do feel the district is doing the best it can, but parents worry, and they worry if their child is next to a child who is positive, and should their child quarantine? These are the kinds of questions parents have right now.
Oh, yeah. I mean, parents are just going through hell having to worry about this. And I know with our grandkids, I think we ought to do. My wife and I are saying, we're not giving you advice on that. There's no right answer. I do agree that the school system, I think, has done an incredible job. They gave 1.5 million meals out and 40,000 iPads to students. And, you know, in a very short window of plan, we ought to be statues to teachers, and I think I said one of the last times on the call, and the transparency thing with just how many kids at this high school are sick, number up,
You know what, John, if I could ask you to call back in as well. We're having a difficult time hearing you on the program, we're just going to make our way through this as best we can.
I could jump on that, Melissa.
Go ahead, Emily. Go ahead, Emily.
Sure. I mean, to this caller's point, and this is something I'm hearing all over from other parents, is how are we supposed to trust this information if we're seeing this lag in numbers and if the calls that we're getting aren't matching what we're seeing in the dashboard? And, of course, that's really concerning and worrisome. Some of the answers that I've gotten from the district and some of the things that we're seeing include that, number one, not every call a parent gets may immediately be reflected on the dashboard because they're trying to call the parents first before those numbers make it to the dashboard and they have to hear from the media or their computer screen before knowing themselves if they're personally affected. The other thing that's worth noting is that the Duval Schools dashboard it reflects who's impacted at school. So a virtual student, full-time virtual, who still attends at school might not make it onto the dashboard, or a staff member that doesn't have contact with students throughout the day that they come on different hours, that might not reflect on the dashboard. School district is saying that's doing everything they can to make those numbers make sense to parents, but that not everything will immediately be reflected. And for that reason, it's why if you look at the Department of Health school transmission database versus the school district dashboard, they don't always match up.
549-2937. Eric is in Arlington. Hi, Eric. Thanks for holding. Good morning.
Hey, Melissa. It seems to me that the conservative Republican Party argument, folks like John Delaney and so on, they, even though they don't articulate this, they sort of hint at it and use code. But I think what their argument is, and even Trump doesn't have the guts to say this, is that it's worth 20,000 people dying to open the schools back up, or it's worth 50,000 people dying to have NFL football, or it's worth 20,000 people dying to have college football, or it's worth, you know, so much business for restaurants and bars or whatever to kill 80,000 people. It's worth it. So that seems to me what the argument they're saying, even though they're not articulating it, they seem to be saying that. Now, the problem with this is, of course, that it could be, this could be construed as genocide, what's going on, because the people that are dying are all of a certain group. They're all, or mostly elderly, mostly poor, and mostly people who have pre-existing conditions. And so I would make the argument that the Republican Party, Donald Trump, by slowing testing, by not reporting, being honest, reporting the numbers, I mean, Ron DeSantis said a couple of weeks ago that that stadiums could act at full capacity for football games in Florida, college or pro. I mean, this is genocide. What the Republican Party is doing could be argued is genocidal because they're killing only members of certain groups. Mostly people in their 20s aren't being affected. Mostly people all the way up until their 60s or so aren't being necessarily affected. You know, and groups with comorbidities are being affected, and the elderly are being. Isn't this targeting of a certain group in order to get business going again? I mean, isn't
all right,
that
Eric.
What we're talking about here?
I'm gonna have. Thanks for the call. I'm gonna have John Delaney respond to that, John.
Yeah, well, it's the country has making a decision that some opening is necessary. Parents are making horrifically tough decisions on whether to send their kids to school or not. And in many families, of course, there's not much of a choice if both parents are working or it's a single parent that's taking care of the children. And it's a horrific risk management decision that's being made, for better or worse. And it's great to point fingers at it. The only thing that will stop it is what the country was doing in the spring, which was to try to shut down. And obviously some people didn't shut down, and some people ended up spreading the infection.
Here's a tweet from a teacher, Chris, a former school board candidate. I think we should be concerned about the district contact tracing. At my school, a staff member went out sick on Tuesday, and they didn't quarantine others until the following Monday, including only one half of a married couple. We do have Nikisha Williams back on with us. Nikisha, I don't know if you've been able to follow the train of discussion, but go ahead.
Yes, I have been following. And what the caller said is very disturbing. There is no amount of death that should be acceptable to any party, no matter what your affiliation is, to open school or anything like that. School is a necessity of our society. So at some point, we knew in March when we first shut down that schools were going to have to open, and we didn't do what we were supposed to do in March, April, May, June, July, August to make sure that caseloads were down to get schools back open. Now that schools are open and cases are still surging, I think school administrators and Duval County School District in particular are trying to make the best out of a bad situation. So if they're notifying parents, which I've gotten 2 notification calls that there was exposure at my child's school, but he wasn't exposed directly. I'm okay with that. They're doing the dashboard. I think we're trying to make the best out of the bad situation. And at the end of the day, COVID is not going away. This is going to be a new reality that we have to live with, like the flu, like the common cold. And so even once a vaccine is out and cases are down, we're still going to have to watch out for this virulent disease that passes through the air, no matter what year it is and no matter what's available to us.
Now, a caller earlier did mention sports and how that's being handled at the college and pro level. We should point out that at UF, they did try to run a full program, and now the whole team is benched, unfortunately, the Gators, because of a cluster of COVID cases at UF. Here's a tweet from a listener. Lately, I've been seeing more maskless people at grocery stores and my hair salon. People are taking it less seriously, and it will result in more cases, she says. It's 549-2937. You let us know your thoughts about the pandemic and how it's affecting local and national politics. Let's talk about this for a minute. President Trump rallied in Sanford, Florida Monday. He has another big event tonight in Ocala, and he held a town hall in Miami last night that was broadcast on NBC. Joe Biden held an event in Florida this week, too, although it was very different from Trump's. Masks and social distancing were both used. The president and Governor DeSantis were criticized for appearing in Sanford without masks, the governor in particular for high-fiving people in the crowd and then rubbing his nose. At the same time, the pandemic dominated discussion at a debate that aired at our partner News for Jax this week between local Congressman John Rutherford and his challenger, Donna Deegan. They did not agree on how the federal response to the pandemic has gone. Let's begin with Deegan. Here's Deegan.
Well, I think I would do just about everything differently. First of all, I would not have fired the pandemic team before we ever had a pandemic in the first place. When the president first found out about how serious this was back in January, he should have been straight with the American people and told them just how difficult this was going to be, that it was going to be deadly, that it was going to be hard.
Rutherford disagreed. He said the president acted quickly, pointing to the China travel restrictions that were implemented earlier this year.
The actual impact of this pandemic was not known at that time. We didn't know a lot about how badly this was going to go. And so we locked down the greatest economy that this country's ever seen.
Okay, Bill Bortzfeld, we should point out that we hosted a virtual debate here at WJCT Studios as well with the candidates for Congressional District 5, Congressman Al Lawson and his challenger, Gary Adler. And so there were a couple of congressional debates in town this week, and the pandemic dominated discussion, no surprise.
No surprise at all. And there's no question that the Republican and Democratic parties are taking a different tact when it comes to the pandemic and how it's handled. I mean, if you look at President Trump versus Democratic presidential nominee Biden, I mean, you often see Trump without a mask. You usually see Biden with a mask. I mean, obviously the two parties are handling this very differently. And that kind of goes to their histories in the sense that the Republicans have often been seen as a party that puts a greater emphasis on capitalism and freewheeling economy. And some would say that the Democrats have perhaps been a little bit more social. And so that kind of plays out in some of what you're seeing in terms of how the pandemic is being handled by the two parties.
Emily Block, there was a big event in Sanford Monday night. The president is coming back for a couple of events in Florida as the week closes out. We're going to be seeing more of this. We've got 2 weeks to go until Election Day. And early voting, we need to point out, starts Monday. And tens of thousands of ballots have already been cast in Florida via mail-in ballots.
Yes, early voting starts Monday. Please let the Times know, Times Union or any of your local media affiliates know if you have questions or if you need assurance that something is going the right way or if you have concerns and you feel like you're being disenfranchised or halted from voting. Please let us know so we can help. But it starts Monday. I know that I'll be out there at different polling sites, Instagram living, just getting an idea of what these scenes look like because we don't totally know if we're going to see socially distanced lines, if it's just going to be quick in and out. So that's something to keep an eye on. And yes, rallies are still happening on Trump's side of things. Like as noted by you, Melissa, Biden is doing it a little differently. But Jacksonville just saw one of those rallies, and it had at least 15,000 people largely unmasked and crammed really close together. So we don't even totally know what that aftermath looks like yet, but it's something we're keeping an eye on.
John Delaney is our former office holder on the line. It's been remarkable to watch the long lines for voting, particularly just to the north of us in Georgia. Some polling sites there, people were reporting waiting 8 to 10 hours to vote. I think that's a function of a lot of interest in this election, and also an unequal access to the ballot in different precincts up in Georgia. We've never really seen lines that long in this part of Florida. But do you think we're going to see some pretty long lines as early voting gets underway in our region on Monday?
Yeah, I do. I think there's just deep passion on both sides, either, you know, for or against Trump or for or against Joe Biden. And there's a beauty to it. There's not a beauty to having to wait over an hour. And I think the thinking is that the early voting and the ability to do the mail-ins hopefully will spread that out over time. But, you know, sort of going, circling back, any large gathering just doesn't make any sense with a virus this contagious and this deadly going around, and both parties make a mistake if they do that. Hopefully the voting processes in Florida will go better, but we don't have a great history of it, that's for sure.
That is for sure. Nikesha Williams, all eyes are on Florida once again. I want to read you a tweet from Dave Wasserman, the U.S. House editor of the nonpartisan Cook Political Report. They do an excellent job of just watching voting trends, reporting polling. Wasserman tweeted this out this morning, or early this morning. The most Democratic trending counties in Florida over the last 4 years are Seminole County, which is Orlando, Alachua County, which is Gainesville, Duval County, which is Jacksonville, Orange, which is also Orlando, and Leon, Tallahassee. The most GOP trending Florida counties are Citrus, Hernando, Sumter, which is the Villages, Volusia County, which is in between Orlando and Jacksonville, and Bay County. And so the reason I read this whole tweet out loud is he included Duval County. It's caught the attention of the Cook Political Report because the demographics in Duval County have been changing over the last 5 years, and that could play a role in how things turn out in Florida on election night.
It's funny that you read that to me. I'm actually working on a similar piece to come out in the next issue of Folio, and it's spot on. This is not the same county that it was in 2016. And when you look at the demographics of Duval County, more people are coming here. We don't have as much snowbird activity, which tend to be older white retirees that tend to lean Republican. And so you're seeing the shift in Duval County kind of mirror the shift of the state almost. Florida is still very much a purple state, probably will be for a very, very long time. But what you're seeing in Duval County is that organic lean towards becoming blue or left-leaning. And so I think that 2020 will show that Duval County is becoming a little bit more progressive in its political ideology. Now, we see that in local government, that's still to be determined, but seeing that in the national politics, the political race, I think we'll get an answer about that in November.
Bill Bortsfield, polling in Florida shows Joe Biden leading Donald Trump, but by a very slim margin, according to most of the polls we've seen. And you and I have been through a lot of election nights, and we know how close races can be in the state of Florida. So wherever people stand politically, it's all going to depend on turnout. But as John Delaney said, I think we can all agree that the turnout's going to be historic this election.
Yeah, I think so. And I think you can also, like you said, we've been following this for years, and we all know that the polls don't necessarily play out as reality. So to take a look at the actual numbers in Duval County, I'm on the Duval County Supervisors of Elections website right now. We have 276,963 Democrats, a substantial lead as compared to Republicans, 237,677. But as we all know, just because there's more of one party than the other in an area doesn't necessarily play out in elections. I mean, if you look at, for example, we have a very strong Republican mayor. Historically, we've seen the GOP do often a better job than the Democrats at getting out the vote. Now, it's going to be a little different this year because we are seeing something historic in the terms of early voting that's been going on, mail-in voting, and we'll probably see really big crowds during early voting. And from what I've read, it sounds like Democrats have been getting a bit of a lead there But then traditionally, Republicans tend to come out either on election day or toward the tail end of early voting. So, you know, polls or no polls, it's all about who shows up at the polls.
Yeah, Emily Block, of course, the interest in mail-in voting is a lot higher than usual because of the pandemic. Kevin tweets the show, please point out that Florida leads the nation in the most COVID cases since June. That has led to this extraordinary crush of mail-in ballots, although we will also see a lot of early voters. And there is worry about if ballots are going to be counted properly, because, of course, we're in the state of Florida. Here is an email from a listener. I did vote by mail, and I used the Dropbox in St. Augustine. I tracked it online, and it showed up as counted within 2 days. So let's point out that Florida's supervisors of elections have learned a lot since the debacle of 2000. And they do have systems in place for you to vote and to track your ballot if you do mail it in. That's something I know the Times Union has been covering as well, right?
Yes, absolutely. That's all available on our website, jacksonville.com. We have breakdowns of what this race looks like, what will be on your ballot, and how you can vote and be sure that it will be counted. We actually did a story, my colleague Andrew, last week that showed that 31,000 mail-in ballots in Florida were either not counted or rejected for one reason or another, and that primarily affected people of color voters and younger voters, millennial and Gen Z voters. But we also include information on, just like that St. Augustine reader said or caller said, how to track your vote, how to make sure that you did everything right and follow it to the process, through the process of being counted, and make sure that your vote does count. So there are ways to do it. There's ways to track it and follow along, even if you're doing mail-in voting because you think that's the safest choice.
Yeah, John Delaney, according to the surveys I've seen, it breaks down into thirds. Roughly about a third of the electorate plans to mail in their ballot, a third plans to vote early, a third plans to vote on election day.
Yeah, and so that should make the line issue, at least in Florida, you know, much better than what we've seen in Georgia. And in Georgia, it's just mind-boggling, the problem up there, and that's clearly going to take some investigations to get to the bottom of it. But you know, you've got a president that has a cult-like following, and he's got a cult-like opposition, and so the extreme passions on each side. You could see it in the hearings for Judge Barrett. Her appointment to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the passions on both sides, and that's going to manifest itself as a big turnout. In saying that, the way the demographic trends in Duval County have gone, I expect Biden to win Duval County. The surrounding counties are, of course, and your listening audience are pretty strongly Republican.
Right.
But it's all going to be a statewide total to see which way the state falls.
Yeah, for both campaigns, it's all about the margins, where they run up votes along the margins. It's 549-2937. We're going to talk about some other news now, beginning with the Mosh being on the move. The Museum of Science and History, did you ever take your child there? Did you ever take a field trip there? You know the museum I'm talking about. It's been on the South Bank for years. Well, they're moving across the river. The Mosh says they're going to build a new museum at the vacant Shipyards property on the north bank of downtown Jacksonville. This would replace their current plans to renovate and expand the museum where it sits now. Nikisha Williams, the Mosh leadership says they want to build on the strong momentum in downtown Jacksonville across the river over the last several years and pick up stakes. Your thoughts.
If you could see me right now, my hands are at my temples because I just don't understand. Why do we have to demolish one building, leave the current space to move across the river to the north bank? Why can't we develop both sides of the river simultaneously, expand Mosh where it is, and develop the north bank and the shipyards and Lot J and everything that the city leadership has been saying for years before I even started to live in Jacksonville. I just don't understand. I understand that a larger space could be advantageous for Mosh on the North Bank and at the shipyards, but I also think they could do more with the space where they are and expand where they are and then develop something else on the North Bank. I don't get the logic.
Bill Bortsfield, what about this? We're getting this announcement from the Mosh at the same time that we hear that a developer is going to tear down the River City Brewing Company restaurant, which is next to the Mosh, and put in an apartment building. There's also controversy over the Curry administration and Shad Khan's plans for Lot J next to the football stadium, mainly because of the hefty price tag for taxpayers. So these are all kind of stories that blend together because they're all being developed in the same tight little downtown footprint.
Oh, they absolutely blend together. And there's no question this is a unified effort. You know, going back to what Nikisha said, I know the Mosh has said one of the reasons that they do want to move across is that they wouldn't have to shut down at all if a new Mosh is built versus renovating the current Mosh. But, you know, let's keep in mind, this is a long way yet from reality. One of the big pieces of the puzzle, we still don't know if the feds are going to let us switch Metro Park for the shipyards. And that is a key piece of so much of what is being talked about, because, of course, you have the Mosh that says they want to go ahead and build in the shipyards. And you have the Jaguars owner, Shad Khan, wanting to expand development to what is currently Metro Park, with the idea being the two would be swapped. And then in that case, the Mosh or bringing a Navy ship to the shipyards, all those types of things, in a big puzzle, make a lot of sense. Now, going back to where the Mosh currently is, it's so much of it depends on what would happen with that area next. Would the building be repurposed? Would it go into private hands? Now, Lori Boyer, who heads the DIA, has indicated that she would still want a public use for that area if the Mosh were to move across the river. So the next couple months are going to be, as journalists, a lot of fun to watch how this plays out.
Yeah. Susan has some thoughts about all this. Susan in Mandarin. Go ahead, Susan.
Yes, I was listening in on the DIA meeting the other day about the apartments that are going to be apartments or condos, I don't know which it is, at the River City Brewing site. And I was wondering if they were going to include parking for Mosh and for Friendship Park and also for people that want to walk the bridges. Because right now the River City Brewing parking is used for that parking at times. So if there isn't going to be parking there, that's going to hurt more Mosh. So I could see why they might want to move. I was kind of troubled when Councilmember Cumber spoke and said, well, we don't really need parking because people can take the bus. If you ever have her on your show, I'd really like for you to ask her how often she rides the bus. Okay, thanks for taking the call.
All right, Susan. Emily Block, that parking lot is a city lot across from the Mosh. What about that concern?
Sure. And my understanding, again, a lot of the story broke when the Fletcher stuff was breaking.
Yeah.
So I'm going to recuse myself from getting into too many specifics, though I know my colleagues have covered it in depth. But my understanding is that parking was something that was considered, and it was something like 30 spaces. Correct me if I'm wrong. That might be for the other
okay.
for the other location.
Yeah.
So someone else might want to jump in there. But I do know that they were speaking about the parking situation in either instance for Mosh. But the whole move is surprising, and I'm sure it is surprising for callers and listeners and readers as well, just because I know I was caught off guard. All I knew was Mosh 2.0, and all of a sudden it was Mosh 2.0 in a different place.
Right.
Like, what? Where did that come from? Yeah.
Chip tweets the show, it sounds like the mayor wants to sell the land where Mosh is so it can pay for the Metro Park development. Bad, he says. John Delaney, what do you think?
Yeah, well, the Mosh site is what I heard a developer call a tragic site. And that it's very isolated. You know, you'd like to be able to go to a museum and then walk next door to get ice cream and then maybe go walk to another museum. And I think the idea, whether this comes to pass, that the Lot J is supposed to be ultimately a center of a lot of activity. The Metro Park site is fairly small, and it has some federal restrictions on it. But the shipyard's still developable, and the location that they're looking for Mosh is really just south of Intuition Aleworks, or south of the baseball stadium along the river. And but as was said, it's a long way to go. That's probably a $100 million project. And the other point of it is building new is healthier for the museum than trying to fit it into the existing space on the South Bank. That's a heavy concrete walled building, and so that idea is that they can make a better project, maybe even for less money, on a new site and continue to operate. Operating is the revenue that keeps the thing going, but it's still got a lot of money that has to be raised either publicly and privately to make the project work.
Absolutely. And Nikisha Williams, what about the other news we've heard that there's a proposal to tear down the River City Brewing Company restaurant on the riverfront? They would add a new restaurant with patio dining and a 335-unit apartment building in that site.
If the plan is to make the South Bank more residential and restaurants and walkability, something like that, and what they have, the district coming up, that's the other development that'll be over there, and then make the North Bank more of entertainment and a museum campus, I could definitely see that that happening. I just feel like the first stall for Jacksonville leaders, and when they talk about development, is tearing down everything that already exists. And yes, you can start fresh when you get everything down to dust, but it just seems like there's never that instance to like start fresh and rebuild. There's always, okay, like just tear it down. And so that concerns me as someone who likes to frequent and go places and do things and take her kid to mosh and that kind of thing. But I can see if you wanted to have an entire museum campus on the North Bank, you have the expanded mosh, you have the USS Adams whenever it's supposed to get here, and then that often talked about aquarium that has yet to come to pass. All that could happen on the North Bank, and then you make the South Bank more residential and more dining for people that live in that area, and that could absolutely work.
It certainly seems that's the plan. Bill Bortsfield, if all of this comes to fruition, we would see a transformed riverfront on both sides. Of course, there are big challenges ahead, given the economy we're in now, and also just the pushback from taxpayers, particularly to the Lot J deal.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's going to be the biggest question of all, tax money. Our tax money, how much of it is a city we want to put into these projects? And of course, the big one right now is Lot J, and the talk of, what is it, a $65.5 million interest-free loan that in return taxpayers would have to foot the bill, and there would be a trust fund set up that in theory would grow the money to get that back. But it is a big gamble. And for those that have lived here for decades, you know, we've seen these types of things, and they always have it always ended well. You know, if you go back and you look, for example, at the Jacksonville Landing, that was a very complicated deal. You had the city that owned the land. You had, Slayman being the last owner of the buildings. And what they ended up paying to get that back and demolish it, if you go all the way back, and I'm sorry, I don't remember the exact numbers anymore, and you look at Tony Slayman's first
you have to go quite a ways back.
It would have been I'm sorry,
No, we're almost out of time is why I jumped in, but that you just showed the breadth of your knowledge, Bill, and thank you for joining us. Bill Bortsfield, our digital editor, former mayor, UNF president emeritus John Delaney, journalist Nikisha Williams, and the Times Union's Emily Block, all providing great insights on the show today. Thanks so much for being with us, everyone.
Thanks, Melissa.
Thank you.
A quick break, and up next, painting and the great outdoors combine in a glorious fall outdoor event, socially distanced, too. We'll preview A Brush with Nature next.
Hungary and Penn, dedicated to agriculture and culinary endeavors, offering picnic meals in a safe, dog-friendly farm setting where social distancing is top priority. Visit congaryandpenn.com for more information.
Wayne Hogan of the Tara Hogan Law Firm.
I'm Wayne Hogan. Distracted driving is deadly.
Teens? Yes. But adults, too. And there are millions more adults than teens. Arrive alive. Let's end distracted driving.
Learn more at waynehogan.law.
More than 300,000 Latinas dropped out of the workforce last month.
I didn't think that I could continue going on. All these emails and phone calls from work and so far behind when I couldn't even take care of my son.
I'm Elsa Chang. It's the latest data point in a recession that has hit women the hardest. This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Starting at 4 on WJCT News 89.9.
This week on Science Friday, how an alternative history of Cortez's conquests fits into the world of science fiction.
We need new ways to narrate our yesterdays just as much as we need new visions of our tomorrows.
Plus an introduction to Chicana futurism on the next Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
This afternoon at 3 here on WJCT News 89.9.
We had a heads up.
This is going to be a long, contentious week.
And heard plenty of pushback.
Your concern is that I'm hostile to the ACA, and I assure you that I am not.
And across the country, record numbers are showing up to vote early. We'll talk about all of it on the Friday News Roundup, next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, this weekend, the Jacksonville Arboretum and Gardens and the First Coast Plein Air Painters will host the 2020 A Brush with Nature Plein Air Painting event. Just picture a beautiful arboretum with painters set up outside on with their work on their easels, painting the beauty that they see. And then you can buy the paintings. This is a great opportunity to enjoy this gorgeous setting and the work of local artists as well. For more about A Brush with Nature, I spoke with Kevin Blaylock, the board president of the Jack's Arboretum. Hey, Kevin. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Melissa. Thanks for having me.
We're all looking for fun activities that we can do safely with social distancing and all of that. Outdoor activities are certainly better than indoor ones, so I'm so excited to ask you about A Brush with Nature coming up at the Jack's Arboretum, which is a gorgeous place and one of the best-kept secrets in town. So let's get the secret out. Tell us a little bit about A Brush with Nature and what's going to be happening.
Well, first of all, I couldn't agree with you more. The Arboretum is a great place to visit, and we've had a lot of attendance. The attendance has increased over the last 6 months or so as people are trying to get out and find something to do. A Brush with Nature is one of our landmark events every year. So we do two big events typically for the Arboretum to try to help raise money for the organization. And A Brush with Nature we've done for 3 years. This is the third year. It is an event where artists come to the site, set up their easels and paint the landscape. So they pick their favorite spots and paint, but it's also an interactive event where our patrons can come and visit at any point during the day, enjoy the site, but also see what the painters are doing and get exposed to the plein air concept.
Right. It's called a plein air painting event. That's basically fresh air painting. It's just a fancy way to say that. Painting outside.
Exactly.
This is a European tradition that has incredible historical relevance overseas, but also here in America. Tell us a little bit more about this tradition and why it's such a beautiful artistic tradition for this community.
Well, I think the biggest benefit of plein air painting is that the artist is outside in the element and taking in what they're experiencing and memorializing that. So it's a great opportunity for them to expand their skills, get closer to nature, and really try to capture that in their artwork. For us and for the patrons of the Arboretum, it's an outstanding opportunity to learn more about that form of art and also enjoy nature at the same time.
And you can attend A Brush with Nature for free, but you are asking for a $3 donation to the Arboretum and Gardens. This is a way to support not only the artists, because you can buy their work, right? But this is also a way to support the Arboretum.
That's correct. So the donation is a suggestion, and it's a suggestion that we you offer consistently throughout the year. We don't, we have a membership process as well, but we ask for donations for people who attend. But the main event here today or this or that weekend is going to be the fact that the artists there are there selling their artwork, and that will be for sale in person. You can purchase a piece of art and have it delivered later. This year we also have, I'm taking a tangent here a little bit, this year we've also created a virtual event for people who are not ready to attend an event outside in person yet. So we have some artists who are actually creating a virtual gallery online, doing the artwork online with some live events on Facebook. And those art pieces of art will also be for sale as part of the event. So we have some options for people who aren't ready to attend in person.
And I want to just take a moment to orient everyone to the Jacksonville Arboretum and Gardens, which is this gorgeous, gorgeous preserve right in the middle of the city. If you've never been, you just take I-295, the Beltway, to Monument Road. You get off on Monument and take an immediate left onto Milko Road, and you are in the Arboretum. This is just a gem in this community, Kevin. Can you describe quickly what people will experience when they come to the Arboretum?
That's right. That's very precise, Melissa. I think that there's a great direction, and it's a surprise when you get there because there is not any indication that there's such a great environmental space to enjoy the outdoors there in that location. So when you get there, you'll realize fairly quickly that there is a curated arboretum with some gardens and some of the best trails in Jacksonville distributed over about 120 acres. We have about 3.5 miles of trails that go back through woods and 13 different ecosystems. So you really can't find that kind of eco-diversity really in Jacksonville or maybe anywhere else in Florida.
Right. So check it out, everyone. It's A Brush with Nature, Saturday and Sunday at the Jacksonville Arboretum and Gardens, sponsored by the First Coast Plein Air Painters. This is a beautiful event. Check it out. And Kevin Blaylock, Board President of the Arboretum, thanks for being with us. It's going to be a lovely weekend outing for so many families. Thanks, Kevin.
Thanks, Melissa. It was great talking with you.
So have fun out there. And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Josh Torres is show director. Our news director is Jessica Palumbo, and Bill Bortsfield runs digital. Make sure to tune in today at noon for the Florida Roundup, our live statewide call-in program rounding up the biggest stories across the state. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect. And this show will be broadcast tonight at 8, or you can catch the podcast later today. Have a great Friday and a great weekend.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.